Have you seen the report on this Condor man? On this man, Wilkins? He is an amateur, do you hear? He is not an agent of the CIA. He is a writer of comic books. Hello and welcome to episode 176 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other failed artists as masterpieces. I am Nick, the KG...
I don't think anybody's actually described this as a masterpiece.
okay, that's true. We should edit the intro for this one. We are discussing a Disney film. Have we done Disney before? Well, Disney owns everything now, so probably accidentally, but this was back when a Disney film meant a specific thing back in the 80s. Or it did to me.
Yeah, they definitely had an image. When they did start doing other stuff, they were very careful to push it out under other brands, even if they owned them.
Yes. Well, we are talking about 1981's Condor Man that I have not seen for, it must be 40 years.
And I can't be much longer.
So, Disney did a lot of live-action films when I was growing up, and that, to me, is what a Disney film meant. Not really animated movies, but these kind of live-action films that were... They were all different. It was like Bedknobs and Broomsticks and Mary Poppins and the Shaggy Dog. But they all had a similar kind of feeling to them. It's slightly... I suppose as an adult, I would think it was maybe sort of sanitized and safe, but it didn't seem that way as a kid. As a kid, it felt kind of, to me at least, it meant it would be a film that I would probably enjoy.
Though, I came in from a slightly different perspective because I will agree that they definitely had an image, and among other things, that image was parents, you can safely take your kids to this and you won't have anything to worry about.
Yes.
The ones I encountered were a couple of the Herbie films.
Oh, yes.
For those of you who have been fortunate enough to miss these, it's basically a Volkswagen Bug. We'll come back to that later.
But
good.
Yeah.
And basically, I can't remember the plots now, but there usually seems to be a race involved. Against vastly superior cars.
Is he even, segue to me, is Herbie even specifically alive, or is he just a reliable car? I'm not even...
No, no, definitely has an actual personality and...
But again, although, yes, from this perspective, those films were probably not good, I'm so brainwashed by my childhood nostalgia that they were good films that I knew I could...
That's interesting, because I think of the Disney transition into animation first as a couple of years later, but to me, Disney was the animation one. It was, you know, back when films came around again at the cinema occasionally.
Maybe it's just the sort of films I encountered as a kid, but it wasn't until the kind of, I don't know, they had a sort of animated film renaissance with The Little Mermaid and The Lion King. But I'd grown past Disney by then. So for me, I never enjoyed like Snow White or Fantasia. They had no interest.
Well, you're not supposed to enjoy them. You're supposed to be terrified by them. Bambi, similarly.
Never seen Bambi. I was not. So maybe that's me. I just wasn't a fan of the Disney films, the animated films. But Disney to me meant these kind of. It's hard for me because it's a similar vibe, and that is a vibe that makes me feel a bit childish and magical. However corporate brainwashy that is, and I'm in no illusions what kind of a person Walt Disney was.
Yeah, and indeed the various people in charge of the company at various times have all been fairly horrible.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I am certainly capable of feeling that particular feeling, but I do not in general feel it with Disney films specifically.
Well, that's fair. It's just good to lay out my working before
start. Yeah,
because Condor Man is very much one of those films. So this is...
We should say, by the way, this is a film suggested by valued listener Robert J. Wolfe.
Oh, yes. Thank you,
specifically, he said, listening to the latest ribbon of memes, I have had to confront that I had the 1981 film Condor Man and the 1984 film Starman entirely conflated in my mind. That's a suggestion, Robert. Be careful what you wish for.
Well, they are quite different films. So this stars... blimey, I've forgotten his name now.
Michael Crawford.
Thank you, Michael Crawford, who, again, will show our working. I grew up, well, not religiously watching, but occasionally watching Some Mothers Do Have 'Em. And enjoying it. It's that
in which he's playing
comedy.
A character who I think I've never seen that, but he seems not entirely unlike his character. He's basically a well-meaning bumbler.
Yes. It is tricky because in Condor Man, well, he's much less of a bumbler. So Some Mothers Do Have Him is very much the kind of comedy that you cannot stand, Roger, which is the kind of look at this absolute moron. What kind of moron things is he going to do today? Ho ho, what a Wally. Let's all laugh at the Wally. It absolutely leans into that. And there's a lot of, you know, when he's standing amidst the chaos of the house burning and everything, it kind of focuses in on him as he goes, oh. So it's just, in there it is bumbling to the 20th degree. He is the...
Honestly, I think if I had seen it, I would have much more trouble accepting him as a protagonist here.
It did affect my feelings of Condor Man watching it this time. So here he is, Wally. Is it Wally? Willy. An artist. To me, he's always Michael Crawford. conflated. Woody. There we go. Yeah. When it was something. And Woody is... I mean, the stick of the film is that he's an artist who draws a superhero called Condor Man, who's...
Draws and writes, we must assume.
Draws and writes, yes, we think so. Who is like a tech-based superhero in the sense that he's built a working flying suit.
I think the term may be gadget hero. At least that's what Champions calls him.
Yes, gadget
hero.
There
may be a certain amount of training and so on as well, but basically you're Batman rather than you're Superman.
Yes, you have no intrinsic superpowers. But he's built a flying suit. But this seems like a terrible idea for someone who writes superhero comics, but his thing is that he will never write Condor Man into a situation that he knows couldn't physically happen. So he has to sort of test all these superheroics, including having a flying suit. So he has designed and built, so as well as a comic book writer, he's also an engineering genius who has built a suit that has eluded mankind from the beginning of time, in that he's built a bird suit that works.
Okay, Roger's Aviation Corner, I'll keep this short, but it is not the design of the suit that's the hard bit. This is the human muscle output.
And the fact that a human weighs 80 kilos or thereabouts.
Yeah.
I think I read somewhere that an angel, an actual working angel, would have to have a breastbone like 3 feet long or something like that to get the musculature on it that would work. Anyway.
Yeah, so similar calculations with flying horses.
Right, yes. Well, you could probably fit a bit, mind you, they're a bit heavier, aren't they? Anyway. So the film opens after an animation, a brief animation like Pink Panther-esque animation sequence where we see Condor Man. I thought he might pop up again, that little animated Condor Man. Presumably that's the comic book character, but he never turns up again. But it was quite a fun little slapstick bit with the Condor Man music that took me back 40 years as soon as it started. I had never forgotten that whatsoever. I mean, there's not a lot to it, but it is very... I think it's trying to... I don't know what it's trying to do, but it sounds like it's being deliberately over-the-top silly, but I liked it anyway.
So there's a thing that... Basically, you can do a parody that's saying, look at how silly these conventions are, or you can do a parody that says, yeah, it's silly, but we've got genuine heart and genuine belief here, and I think this is more in the latter category. And similarly, the first Pirates of the Caribbean film, yes, they're making fun of the pirate film conventions, but they are also having genuine characters with genuine situations.
I think we might have talked about this with Airplane, but I think a parody, you really have to... If you're just sneering at what you're parodying, it doesn't work. It just comes across as unpleasant. But if you come at, like, as with Airplane, genuinely loving these stupid films that you're mimicking, I think that's what you need with a parody to work.
Yeah.
But this is a bit of a bait and switch, really, because Condor Man turns out not to be a superhero film. But I guess we'll come on to that. It starts with him jumping off the Eiffel Tower in a bird suit and floating across the Seine. I think he lands in the Seine, actually. I found that a little uncomfortable because that actually happened to an actual man. I've forgotten his name, but he did. He gathered the media there, said, I've invented this bird suit that works, jumped off the Eiffel Tower. He was meant to push a human doll off the Eiffel Tower, but at the last minute, thinking it would get better publicity, he jumped into his suit himself and jumped off the Eiffel Tower, and it did not work. And that was, it was in the early 20th century, wasn't it? But the man's name eludes me.
Franz Reichelt in 1912 jumped from the first level of the tower to demonstrate his parachute design.
Might be that one, but it didn't work anyway, and he ended up on the base of the Eiffel Tower in several pieces, or one big flat piece. But I found that was an odd, given that I knew that, I certainly didn't know that the first time I watched it, and maybe it wasn't widely known, but I found it was an odd thing to mimic a thing that actually happened.
I would just like to mention that this flying sequence, and the other one we get later, in fact the special effects in general, were directed by Colin Chilvers, who had just done the first two Christopher Reeve Superman films.
Well, he did believe a man could fly.
Well, that was a bit of late publicity, because there were rumours that the flying effects looked really naff. And so the studio started that particular slogan to try to counter that.
It's a specifically quash that. Oh, that's interesting.
So, I mean, on the one hand, yes, you can see some matte fringing and you can see some support wires and things in places. But, yeah, it's competently done. It's 1981, guys.
I'm used to believing that Superman could fly, so yes, I didn't find it very jarring that Condor Man looks like he can fly. It does look a bit naff in areas, but yeah, I agree.
And he was one of those definitely artiste special effects guys, so yeah, everybody on that effects crew was sworn to secrecy. So actually, even now, we don't know exactly how it was done.
Okay, I mean, nobody mind so much anymore other than film historians, because well, they just do it with CGI now. Turns out his buddy watching on the floor is a CIA agent, Harry. But he's sort of a pen-pushing CIA agent. And then we get the establishing scene in his apartment where Woody explains that he will only draw things that he knows will actually happen. Presumably, then, Condor Man hasn't flown in the comic books until this point because he hasn't had a working flying suit. Anyway, I don't know.
There are some bits that aren't entirely consistent. There's a suggestion at one point that this is going to be a new character, and that Woody has been drawing other characters before. But I think that gets forgotten later, because later on somebody's looking at a whole lot of comics. So.
Yes, I certainly got the feeling it was an established character, but anyway, Harry, meanwhile, goes to work and has a problem. Harry's just a sort of CIA pen pusher, really. I'm not really sure what he does, but the upshot is they have a defection. This is the height of the Cold War, and they have a possible defection.
They have a document exchange first.
Oh, yes, a document exchange with a Soviet agent, which is going to happen in Istanbul, but the Soviets insist on a non-CIA operative, or do they just...
In theory, both sides are going to be civilians.
Yes.
But those pesky Soviets obviously cheat, because that's what they do.
So Harry decides to send his buddy Woody.
Sadly, this is entirely consistent with the level of professionalism we associate with the 1980s CIA, except the real 1980s CIA wouldn't have told him who he was working for.
To me, that felt slightly unrealistic, so it's a bit terrifying that that's exactly that's exactly how they operated. So Woody, Michael Crawford's got an American accent here. I'm not sure it's the finest American accent I've ever heard.
It doesn't disturb me. It might well disturb an American.
I suspect, yes, if my partner had seen it, she would have been extremely distracted. But we get some lovely, not enough things are set in Istanbul. It's a beautiful city. And we get a few establishing shots of the Blue Mosque and that sort of thing, and the Topkapi Palace, I think. Anyway,
but the bit where our actors are is entirely studio.
Yes, yeah, they're in a Turkish bar, pub, Turkish restaurant.
Restaurant. There's definitely food involved.
Okay, yes. Where
somebody catches fire after all.
Oh yeah, he orders a flaming sambuca or Istanbul equivalent, and gets a triple of it. This is where I thought the film was going to go very badly south for me, because the screenwriters got to the point that you often mention, if you're running out of ideas, which is two guys walk through the door with a gun. We get two thugs coming through the door. Well, first we meet Barbara Carrera as Natalia, who is the quote civilian that is the exchange documenter.
Yeah, one of her two largely known in the English-speaking world film roles. The other one would be Never Say Never Again a couple of years later.
Yes. Barbara, who was asked to tone down her sexiness for this Disney movie, I believe.
I can believe it. I think she's toned it down to about 1% and she's still burning holes in the film. So.
Yes, exactly. She is. I think she's the most charismatic actor in the whole film. Because I grew up with some others who haven't. We have a scene here where two thugs come in are they trying to steal the documents or disrupt the exchange?
Yes, basically.
And
They are not in sympathy with either the Soviets or the West, I think is the key point here.
Woody, who's got a triple Sambuca in him or whatever he has, he probably didn't finish it actually, but that, in my head, this is how he manages to do it. Accidentally beats them up with a combination of falling over and hitting them, and because he's, I think the scene, I don't know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but he sort of wins because he's so bad. It's like playing a chess player who's much worse than you can't quite predict what they're doing. Is that the idea?
There's some of that. I mean, this is the point at which the film actually won me over. As we've said, I'm not really fond of the whole look at the bubbling fool. But what I would call this sequence is basically incompetence foo as a martial art. And it's really well executed. It could easily have lost me here. It's just, you know, oh, look, silly me, I'm bumbling. But
yes.
But it's effective. I mean, it's not deliberately effective. In GURPS terms, this character has not bought martial arts. He's bought serendipity and luck and all those other powers.
Right, yes.
But even when I started to lose emotion, I could think, that's a really intricate piece of stunt work. And it looks great.
That's true. I mean, well, so Michael Crawford is renowned for being very physical and doing all his own stunts. And some others do have them. Which I genuinely liked, but it did overplay the kind of the holy fool aspect. It's got some really incredible stunts in it, like Harold Lloyd level of dangling from things and dodging things. He's a tremendously gifted physical actor, in the sense that he's very competent at stunts, and I think he's renowned for doing a lot of his own stunts and I agree, actually. So the reason this sequence nearly lost me is because it veers into some Mothers Do Have 'Em territory of, oh, look how he's done this. He's beaten up these hardened killers. And that, I think probably because I'd watched some Mothers Do Have 'Em, I felt like, oh, it's not going to be that sort of film. It actually doesn't desperately lean into that so much as I thought it would for the rest of the film. But here it nearly lost me for probably because of my history. But I agree, talking it over now, there is some wonderful choreography here. And it is, again, one thing we like about action sequences is when they use the physicality of the location, which they really do in this restaurant as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So, having nearly lost me and won you over, Woody manages to swap the documents over. Also, he falls in love with Natalia almost immediately because, well, I mean, she's Barbara Carrera, to be fair. But I do find there is a problem with the film here in that I didn't find they had very much screen chemistry. Maybe that's me, but I just
Well,
did
there's
not.
That specific term you used just now as holy fool, and I think that is absolutely what he is here. And that the holy fool is not a romantic character.
Yes. That might be the problem.
I will. I'll come back to that bit later. But as the childlike innocent, that is not a sexual role.
Oh, that's a very insight. Yes. Yeah, I hadn't. Really
you could picture him loving his mother, but not a goyle.
Yes. Yeah, that's a very good point. That might be why it doesn't quite work for me. So I don't really go for the burgeoning relationship. But also, I don't think as actors they gelled terribly well. Again, maybe that's just because I wasn't going for the relationship, but it didn't quite work for me. Fortunately, it's not a film that hinges upon the relationship working. But that was a thing that didn't work for me. So Woody gets back home. Again, this is, I mentioned a bait and switch earlier. This is it, because you go into this sort of expecting a superhero film, but it isn't really. It's what do you call it? A spy-fi?
It is much more James Bond parody than anything else.
Yes, yes.
And I think the key thing is that he is genuinely terrified a lot of the time, but he's in this situation and screaming isn't going to help getting out of it, so get on with doing the thing as well. I have sympathy with that.
Yes, it's quite a Hitchcockian plot, North by Northwest and the wrong man and all that kind of an absolute innocent thrown into this world of danger and spies.
And we should say that this is loosely inspired, and I say loosely as in they didn't have to pay for it, by Robert Sheckley's 1965 novel The Game of X, which is very similarly the innocent gets asked to do a harmless job and finds that everybody is treating him as this great international spy.
Is that a Bond parody, the book particularly?
It was 1965, so the first couple of Bond films are out. I don't know if we really do that the same way, but the 60s had manias and it was definitely a Bond mania.
It would have been hard to write anything like that with at least having Bond in mind, if you weren't specifically parodying it, because it was such a behemoth at the time.
We should perhaps use the James Bond clock for the state of cinema. This is the same year as For Your Eyes Only comes out. In other words, we've had peak James Bond, which is obviously The Spy Who Loved Me. I will fight you over this.
I find myself in full agreement with that. For me, the best Bond film. I'm not a huge fan of the Bond film, but it might tell you a lot that Roger Moore is my favourite Bond, but he's just the one I grew up with. I always found Sean Connery a bit cold and callous, and his movies quite long and boring, but again, that's when I was a kid.
But anyway. that's where we are, and I think it's fair to say at this sort of date, everybody pretty much knows Bond, even if the kids aren't supposed to see it.
Yeah, I would certainly have watched Bond films on them. It was always on bank holidays. They'd show the odd Bond film around about this time. I agree with you about Bond, but I have a very soft spot for both Octopussy and the terrible one after that. Same Silicon Valley with Christopher.
Oh, yeah, and Grace Jones.
With Grace Jones, who was about a quarter of Roger Moore's age at that time.
That was actually the film which Roger Moore decided he needed to retire from the role because the actress whom he was having the big relationship with in the film was the daughter of somebody he had dated back in the day.
Oh, God. Oh, bless him. Oh, I met it. Again, they give me a similar warm feeling, the Roger Moore Bond film. It's just childhood nostalgia. Anyway, Woody returns.
Natalia goes back to Moscow.
Yes, Natalia goes back to Moscow. And
Boje moi, that is Oliver Reed.
It is Oliver Reed.
I did not know Oliver Reed was in this.
Were you surprised? Well, I saw him on the cast list, so I was wondering who he would be.
I try not to look at this stuff in advance.
He's the main baddie, Krokov. And, I mean, he's Oliver Reed. He had... Have we talked about... I don't think we've ever had an Oliver Reed film before.
I don't think so. But
we nearly did The Wolfman.
My word, he's great.
He... I mean, you can see why he's a star. He had significant issues as a human being. All well documented. But as a screen presence... yeah, I mean, here I would argue he's phoning it in, but even
he's not stretching his acting chops very hard. No, but I don't think the script asks him to be fair.
No, I don't think we want much more than here is a hissable baddie, and he can do that in his sleep and almost does. But he is, yeah, I agree. He's just, I mean, again, this perhaps sort of slightly diminishes Michael Crawford, I'm afraid, because next to someone like Oliver Reed, and I think Barbara Carrera can hold her own with him, but Michael Crawford just...
Isn't that sort of actor?
Well, the problem, I suppose, with Krokov in this film is Oliver Reed is so sort of casually sinister and horrible that I could just... If he actually had 2 minutes alone with Woody, Woody would have zero chance. I mean, he's just... He would just callously wipe the floor with him and then have to wipe the floor afterwards because of the mess.
I can picture a scene in which they don't even touch each other, but Krokov just says the exact right words to completely destroy Woody's self-confidence.
Yes, exactly. So, in a way, he's almost too good for the film because he's slightly too terrifying. But yes, we have a confrontation. Turns out they are they're ex lovers.
She's his toy, basically.
Yes, I think lovers.
That was really the abiding feeling I had in this film, that she is his toy and he is annoyed because his toy is being taken away, rather than because of anything more complicated than that.
See, there's a fascinating film to be made about just their two relationship and how it panned out.
Yeah, to be fair, Disney can't really do much more sophisticated than that because doesn't want to mention sex. Other films of this era have less excuse.
Yes, that's true. Anyway, so we have these two, Natalia and Krokov, they're kind of too good for the film. Natalia's too sexy, Krokov's too terrifying. But it works. We quickly understand that Natalia is in danger or at least wildly unhappy in Soviet Russia. And next thing we know, she wishes to defect to the West. And who does she want to help her defect? Agent Condor Man. The super agent. And so Harry, again, is involved with that. And at this time, the pickup is...
Well, there's a thing, a bit of foreshadowing we'll come back to, because Woody is prepared to do this reluctantly, because, you know, he knows he isn't a super agent or even an agent. But he does insist on having the entire CIA technical toys division working for him to build all the Condor Man gadgets.
I mean, so they have, what, a few hours? It's a very short time frame to come up with Q levels of incredible. They must have had some just knocking around and giving him a new paint job, but he gets a supercar that can turn into a boat. It's very spy-fi. I don't mind that because it's par for the course with this film, but I wish there'd been a bit more. It did stretch my suspension of disbelief to almost breaking point when they come up with all his gadgets, including a working wingsuit, a car boat, complete with rockets. How do you even get a rocket-loaded car across a border? I'm overthinking it anyway.
Piece by piece.
yeah, that's true. He must have had to build them. Anyway, so he drives into... Is it Yugoslavia?
Theoretically.
That's why I was struggling to...
The filming is in Paris, Monte Carlo and Zermatt, and I think this bit is in Zermatt.
But it's back in the days when Yugoslavia was a thing, and he meets her in Yugoslavia as a convenient sort of halfway house between the East and the West.
Mm-hmm.
And we also get the other chief villain of the film,
Morovich.
Morovich, who is a terrifying, again, slightly too terrifying for the film. Though, I don't know, I don't remember having nightmares about him, but he's got this kind of, classic Bond ableist baddie fashion. He's got one eye, but it's a silver. His shtick is it's a silver shiny eye, and he's very
In fact, we only see it in that first sequence. After that, he's mostly wearing an eye patch. I don't know, but I strongly suspect that that sort of trick is usually done with a contact lens, and though they can be bastard painful to wear, I'm told.
Yes, yeah, there have been a number of films where people had to stop working because they couldn't bear the contact lenses they had to wear. Yeah, perhaps that was a kindness on him. Anyway.
So they meet at some place, and of course there are assassins there, and so they have to try to get away. And I think it's theoretically a truck-type gypsy caravan. More or less. This is their getaway vehicle to start with. But the terrifying bad guys are going to come along because they have the fleet of black sports cars.
Yes.
Now, this is the point at which... Oh, all right, I grant you, it's a Bond film. We're supposed to have sports cars.
Yeah.
But I cannot help thinking that when you are chasing a truck... In effect, it's a sports car is very good for going very, very fast along well-kept roads and good cornering and stuff like that. If it were an actual truck, all they would have to do is wait for the one of them to get up close and slam on the brakes. Yes, and the sports car would be destroyed and the truck would keep going.
Fast, not necessarily resilient. Well, you know there's going to be a big car chase because there's no, exactly, as you say, there's no reason for them to have three sports cars other than, well, this must be a sequence now where they're going to...
There is a nice sequence where the engines are heard in the distance and everybody in the village gets off the streets and shuts their shutters.
Yes, I think they're the same village as the ones in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang where they get off the street when the child catcher arrives. Anyway, turns out it's not actually a truck/caravan. It is a supercar. And Woody quickly jettisons the disguise when he realises they're in trouble.
Yeah. This is where I get a bit Rogers out in automotive corner, because that is a very specific car. It's been modified slightly for the film. But basically, it's a kit car. It was sold as a Nova in Europe and the UK. It was branded as Sterling in the US, which is probably what they used. It is, I will readily admit, very stylish, but underneath it is basically a VW Beetle.
we're in Herbie territory again.
And I note that you never actually see them getting in or out. They theoretically slide down from the seats of the truck straight into the seats of the car,
and then the car breaks. Is that because the door doesn't open or something?
Because in the original, the windscreen roof and side windows all come up as one unit.
Okay.
Which looks frankly silly.
It doesn't look cool, sports car kind of DeLorean.
There were variants, but that was the standard model. There are copies of this one in Cannibal Run 2 and Death Race 2000 as well, because it does look stylish. Anyway. But this car sequence is done by Rémy Julien, who was the car sequence guy for James Bond, also for the Italian Job.
Okay, well, the car sequence worked for me.
Yeah.
I should point out the reason the agents have found him is because he wrote the fucking into his comic book.
That's later, I think.
Okay.
And in this case, they found him because They were following Natalia because they didn't trust her.
Okay, I misremembered. Yes. Well, this car sequence really works for me, partly because it's done by people who really know what they're doing, partly because it does involve... I think the reason it works for me, as well as pretty cars driving around, and so he has a classic car with rockets and various gadgets. They made that, considering this is someone who would have to use this instrument panel in a hurry with almost no training. Well, the Q guys made it quite complicated.
It's a lousy user interface. I mean, you have to type in a long sequence to do anything.
Yes.
And then I know some people found this bit heavy-handed. I actually quite liked the parody. You know, he types in the sequence to fire the central rockets and the sports cars instantly go out to the side.
And then he types in the sequence to fire the rockets that are slightly more to the side, or they instantly go back into a line.
Yes, again, I like it because they know what they're doing. Presumably, they're dealing with James Bond types all the time, so they're used to this kind of nonsense.
There was one thing that grabbed me slightly, and it's a thing that I think most people don't really notice or care about, but it's just something I got sensitized to. The compositing, when you're not take a shot through the windscreen of people in a vehicle, but you do not have Steadicam rigs or the budget to do it right, what you can do is, as we have here, you mount a camera on the bonnet of the car against, and put the actors in the car against a blue screen, and then you back project.
Right.
The road behind them. And that has a very distinctive look to me.
Yeah.
Which we have here. I mentioned it, I think, when we were talking about Casablanca, because it just distracts me. But yeah, clearly it doesn't for most people.
It does really. I mean, it works better because I think, I don't know if it's green screen or CGI or whatever.
Or it can be actual back projection where there's just a screen behind them that you project the road onto.
Yeah. Again, I think they parody that in Airplane a little bit. But yes, I agree. It's distracting. But the sequence works for me. And I guess this is relevant for a later sequence, because Woody's here, his bumbling kind of ness, I don't know why, but it works better, because I feel like, or for me it does, he is dealing with lethal stuff, and you can assume he's a good driver. He's involved in the whole thing. He's trying to do it. The enemies are reacting to what he's doing. As you say, they know what they're doing, and it just, he runs out of tricks. I don't know. The whole sequence I found quite exciting. And
he
and
does
fun.
Decoy or cause to crash most of the pursuers. Morovich is the one who's still on him. And there's a bit where he's catching up by bouncing down a bit of rough ground, where anybody who's ever been in a sports car is wincing at this point, because at that point you do not have a car anymore. You have a wrecked suspension. This is the thing. If you can build a car with a suspension like that, but then it doesn't go blindingly fast. But anyway, eventually it comes down. Okay, they've come all the way down the mountain. There is only the water ahead of them. What is he going to do? He's going to drive right off the quay,
and then press a button.
Yeah, but it's not a submarine. It's not for your eyes only.
No, that's the Spy Who Loved Me.
Sorry. Yes.
Not to gazump your Spy Fi. But yeah, it turns into a speedboat, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The design for a speedboat in a sports car is presumably a little different, but...
Well, the ceiling is the difficult. The ceiling is the difficult bit, and then the hydrodynamics. You've got to get the wheels out of the way, whereas in the car they've got to be poking down, so they're the bit that touches the ground.
I suppose in a sports car they're not poking out very much.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's not worry too much about the technology. But yeah, they make their escape with an annoyed Morovich left behind. Is this the bit then where he writes into his? Oh, he's already written into his comic the details of the assignation for some reason. But it's only later that the Oliver Reed character picks up a stack of comics and reads them, and basically
that is at this point. And basically, the whole escape plan is out there, because apparently Woody doesn't have much imagination.
doesn't want to change any of the details, and gets it published before he goes out on the escape plan.
And so they are picked up before they get to safety, wherever safety might be.
Yeah, presumably somewhere in the Western world.
Well, yeah, so, they're already in Monte Carlo.
Yeah, that's true. Don't they get put in prison, and then Harry comes to the rescue in a dreadful disguise with a big beard and bust them out. And then we have the sequence with where they're kind of rocket-powered cable dangly things. Is there a word for that? Are they an actual thing?
No.
So somehow he's arranged to have these rocket packs in a shed in case they got caught. I don't know. It doesn't make sense. But they end up at the bottom of a cable car. They have to get to the top of it. So they have a convenient stack of... Someone's used a story point at this point, and they have a convenient stack of rocket-powered cable car propellers to get up the mountain.
So, again, clearly inspired from Moonraker, there's that cable car sequence where Bond is sliding down on a bit of chain or something, and Jaws is chasing him in the actual cable car.
Doesn't Jaws end up biting through the cable car? I can't quite remember, but something like
that. He also ends up slamming into the thing at the end when Bond gets away. But anyway.
Those are films with hearts, but anyway.
They are. That's why I like the Roger Moore. Was that Moonraker? Anyway, yeah. Doesn't matter. But at this point, Harry gets away, but the other two get knocked off. They capture Barbara.
Yeah.
Barbara. They capture...
Natalia.
Natalia at the top, and then they cut the cables. So poor Harry and Woody drop some distance into soft snow, which the baddies assume immediately kills them, which it might well have done, but it doesn't, because it's soft snow. Though I don't know, is snow one of those... It probably is nicer than falling into water, isn't
yes.
it? It doesn't hit back as hard as you hit it, which water does.
Yeah, so, I mean, several of the extremely high altitude aircraft disaster survivals have involved a lot of snow.
Right, okay. But anyway, the Russians assume they're dead regardless, but they're not dead. They are fine. And I forget how they get out of there. Do we even see? Anyway, they climb out of the snow, but they now have to get Natalia back.
Well, at this point, the CIA is writing the whole thing off. The mission is a failure.
Morovitch, at every point in this, after every failure, he goes all the way back to Russia to tell Krokov that he's, instead of phoning him and staying near where the baddies are, he flies all the way back, presumably flies, and then flies all the way back out again when they come up with another thing.
Oh, obviously, it's one of those supersonic Tupolevs, full afterburner all the way.
Oh, yeah, okay, there you go. He just likes the speed of doing it. And they, instead of taking her back to Russia immediately, they take her to Monte Carlo for reasons that I'm not entirely clear.
Yeah.
But it does give Woody and Harry a chance to infiltrate Monte Carlo.
By basically cheating at the casino, winning big, in the disguise as sheikhs.
Yeah. Slightly blacked up disguise.
And this impresses Krokov, who invites them to the party at his villa the next day. Because obviously that's the thing you do.
Yes, exactly. While you are trying to escape with with the escape KGB agent. I don't know if there's some sense that maybe, again, I'm not sure how clear this is, but maybe Krokov is, as he is a Soviet KGB agent, is corrupt and is actually enjoying his time in the West and trying to make as much money for himself rather than rushing back to Soviet Russia. Maybe he has other plans that don't necessarily align with the plans of the Soviet Union. That was my take on it, but I'm not sure that's ever specifically mentioned.
You could say that. There's nothing, I think, for or against it, really.
No, fair enough. Again, probably overthinking it. But Woody then enters the casino, enters the party, and they have a plan, an almost plan.
But first we have the frankly tone-deaf emotional moment.
Oh, what, where he confronts her on the balcony?
Yeah, and he's saying, don't worry, we'll get you out of this, and she's saying, no, leave me, you're just a comic writer, which she has discovered along the way.
Yes.
And this would be fine if it went anywhere, but the moment the explosion happens and they start the rescue, well, they've started the rescue and she goes along with it, so.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I had very little memory of it because it's just emotionally flat. It speaks to my feeling. There isn't much of a relationship there. I didn't really care whether she liked him or not. It's a bit of a, yes, let's tick this screenwriting box because they need to have some inter-party tension as well as external tension. Yeah, you're right. That's almost immediately discarded. Things blow up, and then we get finally. So he ends up with Natalia climbing to the top of this villa, and we get the second flying sequence of the whole thing because it turns out he had the flight suit on his back, which is why he looks like a slightly weird hunchback. And he flies her over to the docks. Again, there's not, I mean, that is the sum total of the Condor Man flight sequences. But there's not
carrying two people is not trivial. I mean, carrying one is quite hard.
There's not many birds that can carry very much when they fly. I suppose rocks can fly off with elephants, but no. That's the problem with a flying superhero. It's not very exciting in itself, intrinsically flying. So that's all he does. But anyway, he flies off. We get the... Again, it's a nice flying sequence over Monte Carlo. He flies down to the docks. To be fair,
this is largely a descent. I mean, he's going from this villa, which is up on a hill somewhere, down to water level.
I don't think he ever does anything else, does he, with his flight suit? Yes, there's no suggestion he's particularly aerobatic or anything like that. He's basically gliding. Again, still wouldn't work, but yeah, that's fair enough. He doesn't make too many demands on his flight level.
But there is a moment of brief tension as Woody gets stuck in traffic. Sorry, as Harry gets stuck in traffic. But basically, they get backed up. They all get down to the dock at the right moment.
Yes,
where there is a speedboat ready to go.
But of course, the baddies have multiple speedboats as well.
And everybody puts helmets on, which means you can't see their faces very conveniently.
Yeah. Well, this was the contrast I alluded to earlier, that while the driving sequence I enjoyed and worked well for me, I think you put your finger on it off camera. There's something about this sequence that is just not very interesting.
Well, yeah, and the way I think of it is that a minor confrontation in a Bond film can see, yes, I've got the gadget. Thinking of The Spy Who Loved Me, the car and helicopter chase in that. We've got the guys on cars and motorcycles who can be fooled by smoke screens and spike droppers and all that kind of thing. But when you've got the helicopter pilot, it takes on the a bit more, which isn't... Yeah, he could, in theory, just fire the missile while on the road, but he doesn't do that. He drives off the end, converts the thing to submarine, and then fires the missile from under the water because that needs a bigger character moment.
Yes.
And similarly here, well, not similarly here. Oh, we have a laser machine gun now. The thing is that. This is basically gadget versus gadget, this final confrontation, with one slight exception, which I'll come back to. They have a rocket rack, we have a laser machine gun, they are pursuing us, we are. There's nothing that is specifically Woody.
No, about and this. Similarly, there's nothing very Krokov, who is a passenger with a stupid helmet for this whole sequence. Morovitch is driving the boat.
So it felt to me like an emotional lacuna. Yeah, this should be hero versus villain, and the hero proves his moral superiority or his cunningness or something. Yes. But what all the hero proves here is he's got better gadget designers.
Yes, and I feel like in a Bond film that, at this point we've probably already had the... No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. Oh, the confrontation, where he explains his master plan and Bond, as you say, proves he's better in some way. So you have a very personal confrontation. And then maybe you have the scenes in Monte Carlo don't really do that for me particularly.
What we get in the end is the Condor boat is picked up by a heavy lift helicopter, which just happens to be waiting in the exact right place. Super fair, by the way, for those interested. And Morovitch, being obsessed, just carries on trying to ram, and then the boat is lifted out of the way and he runs onto the rocks. And fortunately, Krokov has dived overboard when he's realised what his minion is up to.
Presumably to keep him alive for the sequel, which never happened. But it's just watching boats exploding. I don't know. Yeah, I agree.
All right, a small artillery corner. Maybe I'm the only person who spotted this, but I want to give small credit to the production designer who, given that he has been briefed, have a Russian boat firing rockets, has based it on the Katyusha rack.
Right.
The classic rocket rack on the back of a 6-ton truck used in World War II.
It doesn't affect the plot at all, but, oh no, I mean, it could theoretically more or less work. Let's not talk about the reloads. But the point is it's a visual thing that says to me, Soviet military design. And maybe that wasn't their plan.
No, I agree that. I'd never even registered consciously, but I agree that absolutely does the trick.
But yeah, there is this basic problem that a rocket that you fire one off is a lot less effective than a laser machine gun.
Yeah, it turns out it's a bit of a... Yes, for a number of reasons, it's a bit... them having the right gadgets at the right time and everything being picked up is all par for the course for this sort of film. But it doesn't have any kind of emotional climax to me.
Well, the other thing is I'm going to come back to the Holy Fool thing because... Woody doesn't really have a character arc. He starts off as a holy fool, he ends as a holy fool with a girl. But yeah, he's basically the same guy.
Yeah, which again, that's great for, iconic characters like Indiana Jones, or James Bond, but here...
There is the implication that he's going to carry on doing the occasional mission for the CIA. But.
Well, yeah, it sets up a kind of Condor Man will return kind of thing at the end, but he didn't because he did.
Complete with that classic 70s freeze frame, as everybody. Yeah.
Yes, I agree. It wraps it up pretty quickly afterwards, and everyone's happy, and Condor Man is going to be a fully fledged agent, possibly not. How did I feel about Condor Man overall? We have a friend who is a massive fan of Condor Man and loves it and listens to the soundtrack. I think it must have just, without speaking for him because he's not here, it must have just hit him at exactly the right childhood time in the same way that, like, Octopussy worked for me. I've still got a lot of happy memories of that film. But objectively, it's hard to call this a great film, is it?
No, it's not a great film, but I think it... This is a concept we'll come back to in future episodes. It doesn't aim very high.
Yeah, okay, true.
It's got probably more budget than it should have had. I mean, hiring Remy Julien is not cheap. Hiring what was his name? The Superman.
Henry Mancini doing the music.
No, Colin Chull was the Superman special effects guy. It was not cheap.
Yes.
As a result, it looks expensive in the production values, but cheap.
Yes, I agree.
Michael Crawford is not that great an actor, and the script isn't that great, and.
Well, I think that's where it falls down, I'm afraid, is on Michael Crawford's shot. So for me, yes, I agree. It doesn't aim very high. For me, it doesn't quite hit that target either.
But I did have fun with it.
Oh yeah, I didn't. I mean, I wasn't actively annoyed by it. I enjoyed it. And it does hit that sort of old nostalgia feel for me.
Yes, there's definitely that look of 70s, 80s Disney live action.
Yes. But it doesn't, I think if it had a more satisfying, again, I don't know if, not everything needs a character arc. James Bond is usually the same person at the end than he was at the beginning. And when they veer off that, the film's usually...
Yeah, but there isn't a James Bond film that says this is his first mission. Well, maybe there
Casino
isn't.
Royale, the new Casino Royale.
Yeah, which I haven't seen.
It's quite good for that, but then the problem is you have to end up with James Bond at the end of it. I don't really buy the relationship. I found the ending a bit emotionally flat. I think though, and I found Michael Crawford, engaging and certainly not dislikable, but not particularly charismatic for this sort of film either.
To be fair, I don't know what other film roles he's had, and I don't know how the direction affected this. I mean, I could see the Disney director saying no kissing, for example.
Yes.
And just bearing in mind, though, this is 1981. Other films that we've talked about from 1981, Escape from New York, Mad Max 2, Raiders of the Lost Ark, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
You put it up against those, it looks a bit shabby.
It does, doesn't it? It's, I mean, it is no masterpiece. And even, even on its own terms, I don't think it quite hits what it's aiming for. I don't remember, so I would have been, what would I have been, 5 or 6 at the time, so I wasn't around for any kind of hype around the film, or wasn't aware of it. I don't remember anyone being particularly excited about Condor Man for a long time afterwards.
What I remember people saying at the time, and I didn't hear about this one specifically, but what was generally the case was somebody would say, there's a new Disney, yes, rather than there is specifically Herbie whatever or Condor Man whatever.
Yeah, which survives to this day. It's just it's now usually an animated CGI thing. Yeah, I absolutely agree. It was a Disney film, not a specific, in the same way that there's a new Bond film. Yeah. But yeah. I don't remember this one particularly standing out. I don't think it did massively well at the box office, and certainly didn't get a sequel or anything like that.
It was heavily panned. In modern Rotten Tomatoes, it's got 27%.
Wow.
Well, there's much worse. I mean, the next one we're going to talk about is in that sort of category, and it's a much better film. There was a comic book, briefly.
And a novel.
There was a novelisation. They brought it out on VHS the next year. It got a DVD in the early days of DVD releases.
Presumably, you know, this is post-Star Wars. There are a load of Condor Man toys, but I don't remember ever seeing one or even hearing about one. I'm just guessing there, but it would be surprising to have such an iconic character in the early 80s and not have a ton of Condor Man toys come out at the same time. But presumably they didn't do tremendously well either.
It was one of four big flops for Disney in 1981. Exact numbers are hard to get by. I've seen 9.5 million bandied about as the loss they took on this one. This is part of the procedure that leaves people at Disney thinking, we're not doing so well with turning out the same old stuff again and again, maybe we should do something different.
Which, yeah, so it eventually leads to the Lion King and what have you, I guess. Aladdin was probably the first of those. I mean, it's a piece of entertainment, and I'm increasingly of the opinion that films really are at their best when they just are pieces of entertainment. So I have no problem with it being anything like that. I'm quite happy it exists. I quite enjoyed it.
Would we recommend that the listener track it down? No.
Not especially. There are better films. Well, I think that's my problem with it anyway. There are films that do the same thing better. We've mentioned The Spy Who Loved Me a number of times. And if you want to see this kind of film done really well and really enjoyable, I agree. The Spy Who Loved Me is probably the best example I can think of.
And when you've seen that, Moonraker is basically the same story again, plus space. So,
well, it was after Star Wars, they had to put space in.
Yeah.
The book is nothing at all like that. But then none of the books are much like the actual film. So, but yeah, The Spy Who Loved Me is a good, maybe we should talk about, maybe it is a masterpiece, but that to me hits exactly the target that this is trying for, and this Condor Man, which I'm not unhappy with. I don't feel bad feelings towards it. I don't particularly like Michael Crawford. I don't particularly dislike Michael Crawford. I think his future roles were mainly on stage after this, possibly as a result of this not doing tremendously well.
And he's charming. He's all shucks good-natured. But
just hasn't quite got the charisma. Well, again, Oliver Reed has, and he's not even trying, you know, and I don't, it is classic indefinable star quality that Michael Crawford just doesn't have here, and he's not as interesting to look at. I think he gets too little opportunity to do what he's best at, which is that kind of physical stuff like he does in the Istanbul Cafe. There's very little of that actually in the film. I thought there'd be more.
But there's there's the initial fight when Natalia's defecting before the car chase.
Yes, on the hill in the castle, or ruined, whatever it is, ruined fortress. But there we are. I mean, by all means, watch it if you catch it on a rainy afternoon and feel nostalgic for this sort of thing.
So Crawford, he was in a funny thing happened on the way to the forum, but basically everybody who was within half a mile of the studio was in that. He was in the film of Hello Dolly that was moderately successful at the time. A lot of relatively minor roles, as far as I can see.
I suppose I might. I wouldn't be unhappy sitting down to watch this with my kids. Though, I don't know, my oldest is 11 and might already be a bit old for this. So I suspect they would probably enjoy it, but there are better examples.
Yeah, so, my feeling was there was enjoyment to be had here, and I had it. There are certainly films we've watched for this that I like less, but it did take a certain amount of effort to find that enjoyment.
Yeah, but it didn't make me despair for humanity like Glengarry Game Ross, for instance. Well, let's leave it there for Condor Man, who may return. I don't know, Disney digging out all their old properties now, so you never know, we may see another Condor Man at some point.
Grim and Gritty TV series, you heard it here first.
Oh, God.